If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
It's Monday, November 13th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. A very harrowing story on the cover of the New York Times. It was about the plans of Mr. Donald J. Trump. Perhaps you've heard of him. Sweeping raids, giant camps, and mass deportations inside Trump's 2025 immigration plans. Well, the plans make references to the camps and raids. My question is, will there be camps and raids? I'm not discounting the depths of this man's soul or his retinue. I am wondering about the issues of execution, which he would like to do to many, many illegal immigrants. But this story, though unprecedented, it was also strangely familiar. Where had I seen this presentation before? A splash page, Trump set against a dramatic backdrop, doing a presidential or candidatorial business. Here he was speaking in front of Kleeglites as no doubt a rally cheered his words about immigrations. Oh yes, let us go back to July when the New York Times had a story of Trump descending, if not Air Force One, then Trump Force One, under the headline, Trump and Allies Forge Plans to Increase Presidential Power in 2025. That A1 article by Jonathan Swan, Charlie Savage, and Maggie Haber. This one, months later, by Charlie Savage, Maggie Haberman, and Jonathan Swan. Each has obligatory references to the courts maybe having something to say about that. This weekend's, that policy's legal legitimacy, like nearly all of Mr. Trump's plans, would be certain to end up before the Supreme Court. That article, back in July. Other former Trump administration officials involved in the planning said there would also probably be a legal challenge to the limits on a president's power to fire heads of independent agencies. Mr. Trump could remove an agency head, but teeing up the question for the Supreme Court. So in both cases, Trump offers through his minions, through members of his retinue, some wild plans. They could point to a clause or two in federal legislation. They can issue a phrase like Schedule F. Seems kind of scary. Wasn't that what the emperor used to turn all the stormtroopers against the Jedi? Anyway, the people who are being interviewed love the chance to get on the front page of the New York Times and make it seem scary and legitimate. Scariness is the point. But actually doing the thing is less of the point. So it's definitely an excellent piece of campaign rhetoric. And were it to happen, it would be a horrible piece of legislation. But the gap between, well, let's put aside the question of will Trump get elected, but the gap between coming into office and wanting or saying you want to do this thing and actually doing that thing, that gap is the most persistent, yawning gap of the Trump experience. We can all remember quite a few things he talked really big on and then didn't do. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's a peace treaty and Kim Jong-un gave up his nuclear weapons and decided to go into the real estate business in North Korea. Maybe that happened and I missed it. From everything, the little things from parades in Washington, D.C. with tanks to quite infamously, this big giant wall that the Mexicans were going to pay for. Lots of things that'll get you on the front page. Lots of phrases like Schedule F. Not a whole lot of actually doing it. And I wouldn't dismiss this, and I wouldn't shunt this aside, but I could have used a few more paragraphs on the, yeah, even though he says so, and even though the courts might get in the way, there's a whole lot of other obstacles between Donald Trump and the quote that ended the July piece. We will demolish the deep state. We will expel the warmongers from our government. We will drive out the globalists. That quote also echoed in the quote that ended the recent piece from Stephen Miller. Bottom line, President Trump will do whatever it takes. A lot of distance between that rhetoric and actually doing the thing. Don't think me sanguine. Don't think me dismissing the possibility that very curdled, dangerous man would like to at least give someone with more energy and wherewithal than him the ability to try it. Don't think that's not true, but there is a giant difference between someone pointing to a schedule with the letter F and actually being efficacious in changing major U.S. policy. I am right now, by the way, I speak to you. I think I'm in the air. I might be on the ground. I am either going to or in Israel. I am in Israel. A friend of mine, Foot the Bill, a listener of the show, he said, come to Israel. I have this program and you will meet government officials. We will tour some of the kibbutzes. Kibbutzim is the plural down south that got hit by the October 7th terrorist attacks. You'll meet with all sorts of people that you're not going to ever be able to get a chance to be in the room with, let alone ask questions to. So that's why I'm here doing my journalistic duty. I will bring back the tapes of the interviews I have done. We are always interested in doing what it takes to track down fascinating talkers and people in the middle of major world-changing events. And as I said on the Saturday show, we're trying to get a broad swath of opinions of experts. But here I am in Israel doing what I can do to learn, have conversations, and bring it all back to you. On the show today, General Gus Perna is a retired four-star general and was the chief operating officer of the Federal COVID-19 Response for Vaccine and Therapeutics. You might know it by its catchy name, Operation Warp Speed. He joins to talk about the logistics of distributing the vaccine to the U.S. and if private businesses need to take a military mindset. You know, yeah, you could guess what he'll say, but what he says beyond that is interesting. General Perna up next.
Podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Gus Perna is a retired U.S. Army four-star general, and he was chief operating officer of Operation Warp Speed. I encountered him in one of the best books I've read in a while, and you heard my interview with the authors Joe Nocera and Bethany McLean, The Big Fail, what the pandemic revealed about who America protects and who it left behind. Gus Perna has been protecting America, and I wanted to talk to him about some of the lessons of his life in logistics and running that extremely successful and extremely critical program. Welcome to The Gist.
I really appreciate it, Mike. Real pleasure, and thanks for the opportunity.
So I know in the military there is this phrase, task and purpose. It's an online magazine, but tell me what the task and purpose was of your endeavor there with Operation Warp Speed, and maybe how the task differentiated or differed from the purpose.
Yeah, so it is a little bit different. You know, it's always, I grew up always defined purpose, and then you figure out what and how you're going to do things. It's not the reverse. I see, unfortunately, a lot of leaders doing that, and it usually leads to a fool's errand, for lack of a better choice of words. Quite frankly, as we were watching, and I was extremely frustrated, you know, you weren't going to solve this big problem in a media soundbite at 5 o'clock. you know, which I thought was just really drove me crazy. So when I got the call to do this, several things went through my mind, and I'd be happy to talk to you about those. But the one thing I really had to get clarity on was purpose, because I felt that we really had a chance for not defining that right, which would have distracted us from doing what we needed to do. And so I got the call on Saturday morning, give or take a day. I was up in the Pentagon on Monday. I was in the Rose Garden on Friday. That week was about codifying purpose, mm-hmm. and the purpose that the Secretary of Defense finally approved and the chairman was safe and effective vaccines and therapeutics for the American people as fast as possible. And so that became our purpose. The what and how we did things was left up to me. And I'll be happy to talk about that. But, you know, once you have clarity of purpose, then people underneath you can do things without you having to be involved in every single thing. That's why that's so important. Number one. Number two, you don't get these phone calls that says, hey, now we want you to, you know, track generators and track, you know, masks and track this and track that, you know, because when you have that clarity, then it's really, it's easy to fall back on.
Right. The purpose of the organization doesn't expand. The better you do at one thing, you don't get tasked with other things, and it doesn't. And then it probably also means your resources don't get stripped away from you once everyone involved is clear on the purpose.
Yeah. Also, you know, when you start proving that you can do things, people want to throw more stuff in your rucksack.
Exactly.
And that becomes a huge distractor because the organization, you know, wasn't designed for that, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we had a serious situation on our hands, and clarity of purpose is something that I've grown up with, and it was easy for me to get to and lead from there.
So when they say as fast as possible, is that useful or not useful to you? It's hard to give a deadline because it's unprecedented. So how could a deadline be at all reasonable, no matter what date they set? But on the other hand, without a deadline, where's the accountability?
Yeah, we needed something. What I will tell you is not one time that I ever receive a phone call that says you're not going fast enough. Or, you know, I need you to, you know, get here sooner, or how come you're not doing this? I never received that. You know, what that important part was is, hey, we're not waiting around for 2 years. You know, and what's really important to connect to fast as possible was the upfront statement, safe and effective, right? Vaccines and therapeutics. So that was my purpose. I could not violate that. I couldn't bend the laws of physics to achieve faster than safe and effective would be. And I swore an oath to that, you know, quite frankly, in the big scheme of things. And that was my order, and I was not going to let that happen. But as you just articulated, you got to have a goal line that you're heading towards. You know, we can't just drift like a piece of wood going down a river, right? We had to have focus. We had to have energy. We had to hold ourselves accountable. You know, we had to fail early. We had to, you know, prioritize, et cetera, to that end. And so that's where I was, you know, and it was a good place to be. Trust me, I knew what was happening all around us, and everybody that worked for me knew it. There was enough energy to get us to where we needed to be.
When you joined, did you even know what the state of the science was? If the pharmaceuticals had been sufficiently developed, were you read in on even what RNA is and does?
No, but the beauty of Secretary Esper, Secretary of Defense, and Secretary Alizar, you know, was the Secretary of Health and Human Services, was these two leaders got together and were taking the best of both organizations and putting it together, you know, in order to achieve our purpose. And so Secretary Azar brought in Dr. Moncef Salawi, who is a world-renowned scientist the best in the world in making vaccines, and had been already credited with 14 vaccines that he was involved in bringing, you know, to bear. And so when I got the phone call, my job was about setting up the distribution of the vaccine. It quickly expanded after we got together and we realized how much was not happening. But I was focused on distribution. Dr. Salawi was focused on the right science and the selection of the right vaccine. Now, I sat in every meeting with him. We worked this, we were co-leaders, we respected each of our expertise. He would come in my office and, you know, give me a class on vaccines and mRNA and talk to me about the criteria for the six that he was going to recommend for selection, you know, because part of the criteria was it had to be feasible based on trials, right? It had to be, you know, we had to be able to get it made. We couldn't have a vaccine that would take 5 years to make.
Right.
You know, that kind of defeated the purpose. We couldn't have a vaccine where we couldn't get the supply chain to support it. We couldn't have a vaccine if we didn't have the facilities to put it in. So him and I had to work together on that. But he was the guy, the genius, really remarkable leader, scientist, person that was responsible for the vaccine. But as I said, we sat together because we are both going to be accountable to that end.
So I remember during before the vaccine was available, reading about it, people in the know would say one of the major hurdles would be to ramp up production, that even if you could invent this, you know, there aren't enough factories in the world to make this vaccine. So to get over that hurdle, I want to ask you what you did. But just judging by your last answer, was part of the actual vaccine that you chose based on the fact that this is one that we think we can get enough factories and enough facilities online to make it?
Yes, but not in a definitive you know, go or no go format. It was, you know, we did the what we call in the Army mission analysis to see if it was feasible. And if it was feasible, then we figured out how we could, you know, bend the laws of physics to get there. And if you'd let me back up one moment, you know, we had a clearly defined purpose, safe and effective vaccines for the American people, then figuring out what and how we had to do things. So, you know, the what. Dr. Salawi picked six vaccines, there was three different types, two in each category, so that we'd have diversity. And if one failed, another would be successful, et cetera, et cetera. The second thing we knew we had to do was design trials that were more than normal, right? Normal is somewhere between 1,000 and 3,000 people over 5 years. You know, we wanted to do 30,000 people in 90 to 120 days to have the mathematical solution to define or tank the success of the vaccine. Then we had to figure out manufacturing. You know, do we have enough? Do we need to create? Do we have enough equipment? Do we had to expand, et cetera? And not only for the vaccine, but also for syringes and needles, also for vials, also for consumables like plastic bags and tubes, et cetera. Then we had to figure out the distribution network that didn't exist. You know, the flu vaccine goes out to roughly 7,000 locations, and then it's dispersed down further. You know, the vision I had was we wanted it to go out to as many places that people would consider normal: doctor's offices, hospitals, pediatricians, CVS, Walgreens, Walmart, the mom and pa, you know, drugstore that everybody knew for, you know, their whole life. So we went from 7,000 locations to over 70,000 locations, which took a lot of work. And then we had to figure out the administration of the vaccine, you know, how to track, you know, how it goes in, et cetera, you know, how much vaccine stays good and it goes bad. So we had to be able to see ourselves. We had to create a system that we named Tiberius to go track from manufacturing, the supply chain, the distribution, the administration, and if required, the destruction of vaccine if it went out of tolerance or if it was hurt. So we had to do all that. Now, to your question, you or I think as you were pulling through the thread through the needle, right? The way we bent the laws of physics is we bought risk out. So we went to the six companies. We did a contract with them as early as June. We said, no matter how the vaccine comes out, good or bad, we're buying it all from you. If it's bad, we'll throw it away. If it's good, we want you to plan for good. And then that way we started doing the process as early as June and July and August, September, which meant, you know, it's you have to make a little bit, get everything validated. Then you make a little bit more and get it all validated. Then you have to, you know, you have to go. It's just you don't all of a sudden create this big giant vat, right?
Yes, yes.
With 100 million doses in it. You have to, you know, scale up to it. So when we bought, when we took away the risk, right, that allowed them to start working through that process. That's why when we increased the trials, we were able to really get the numbers we needed, right, for the FDA. The FDA approved it, you know, from May to December. When the FDA approved it in December, we were delivering vaccine 24 hours later because we did that. And then other things we added to that, right? We could see ourselves, as I talked about. We created battle rhythm for meetings, you know, which included industry leaders had to sit in. Scientists had to sit in.
What does that mean? Battle rhythm.
It's a military term. It's just a way to manage the flow of meetings so that they're connected, they're integrated. You have the right people there. Everybody knows what decisions are going to be made, etc. You know, we brought in the right team from Department of Defense, handpicked people, experts in contracting, experts in medical, you know, experts in distribution and logistics operations. We kept it a flat organization, right? So decision-making was quick with me, right? It didn't take 4 weeks to get to me. They walked into my office that day, you know, et cetera. And then probably the big thing that, one of the things that I often think about, could I have done it differently, is even though I was a four-star general and everybody knew who I was when I walked in the room, I felt it was very important not to walk in the room and say, I'm in charge, you're going to do what I say. What I thought was important was we want everybody's expertise, we want everybody to be heard, and then we would drive operations to create the effects we needed. So in other words, we wouldn't linger on decision-making. We weren't looking for perfection. We were looking for safe and effective. We were looking for volume. We were creating the necessary things that we needed to get done. So, you know, I wasn't waiting for perfect. So I bought 1 billion needles and syringes in July. We expanded vial capacity in July through October. We created and bought consumables in July and August, right? If all the vaccine went in the toilet, okay, that would have been something. But because we were driving ourselves to these effects, right, we were prepared. You know, and so I dubbed that. I used to tell my team, hey, we're going to lead from behind. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not get up and yell and scream and follow me and beat your chest. This was, you know, we're dealing with industry, the most brilliant minds in the world, you know, in industry, the most brilliant scientists in the world, right? The government agencies that are really just powerful organizations. Mm-hmm. And we were collectively weaving them, you know, to get the effects that we needed. So leading from behind became a mantra within my 100 people or so.
It's obviously such a tough task. What were some of the tough elements that you didn't think would be tough, that surprised you as being especially tough?
Yeah. So, and I know everybody knows this, but I'm going to say it to kind of set the conditions. It's been over 100 years since we worked something like this, right? The Spanish flu. There was no playbook. There was no organization. There was no financial stream, you know, that came directly to you. None of that existed. So everything was done by scratch. quite frankly. And I constantly, to your question, I had people, a lot of people trying to defend status quo. Well, this is how we do the flu vaccine every year. You know, General, this is how we manufacture it. Oh, General, we know how to distribute it. You know, it was a lot of all that conversation, which was good to understand, but maybe not necessarily good for the effects we were trying to achieve. And so I had to get people past status quo. And I had to get them their intellect, their work ethic, their brilliance, thinking about being innovative and adaptive and agile and providing solutions, you know, understanding that there was going to be risk, but we would mitigate it, you know, with a red line of never violate safety, right? Or effectiveness. But otherwise, we'd figure out, you know, what we could do. And perfection is the enemy of good enough, right? Yeah. And we had to press. So that was one. Two, I will tell you, and I'm proud of this, because I served both presidents, President Trump's administration and President Biden's administration. Myself and the DOD team were the only people that transcended, you know, between them and stayed. I received absolute priority and absolute resources from both presidents without question, which was really, really important. With that said, there was organizations that were so attached to their bureaucracy that they didn't know how to break out of that, right? They, you know, hey, look, I got it. You asked me how much money I think we need to get this done. I gave you a number. I'm not going to sit here for 3 days and defend the number. I'm telling you the number. Go get me the money. And if you don't want to get me the money, I'll see you tomorrow in the president's office. Because, you know, that's the kind of things you have to do, right? And both presidents, and I'm over-exaggerating my point, but both presidents gave that to us, which I thought was really, really powerful. But I was taken back a little bit by the defense of our bureaucracies.
And we will be back after a break with more from General Gus Perna.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to The Gist. We continue our conversation with the man who was the chief operations officer of Operation Warp Speed, General Perna. With your team, with the brilliant minds in science and business, were there ever times when greed interceded, or when pettiness, when defense of turf that was something other than just understandable based on how it's always been done. Something a little uglier presented itself.
I never saw greedy, right? It was a unity of effort to solve a problem, through industry, academia, and the government, right? It was really powerful to watch, and I was proud of it. Every once in a while, we'd all fall into, we all have our organizational or an individual purposes. You can't help that. That's life, and you just got to work your way through that. And that's why you have meetings and you drive them and the battle rhythm and a leader that's willing to assess and take risk and move. So never greediness. I did see every once in a while somebody willing to fall on their sword because this is the way we did it. We should be in charge, not you. I don't understand why you're here. We're the experts. So it was really easy. At the end of the day, it was simple. If they didn't listen in public, then we went in private and we had a conversation about, okay, here's what's happened. Dr. Slowey and I are in charge. Mm-hmm. The reason why we're in charge is because it wasn't getting done before we came in. And now this conversation is over. I chose to do it professionally and not in public. But don't let this continue. We had good professional conversations that didn't last. The situation didn't last. Again, we're all humans, right? You don't want to be, you're a professional. You want to be good at it. It's not easy to be told you're not doing your job. And that wasn't the case. Everybody cared. Everybody understood the problem. Everybody just had different ways of trying to solve it.
Was it more a problem that there was not enough data or too much data?
Yeah. So that's an important question. I think, and I would never speak for Dr. Slowey. Him and the scientists really, they were the experts and they had what they needed to make their decision. And I have absolute trust and confidence in that. I really do. In them as individuals, professionals, and really elite people in your field. Where data really came into play on my side was about, do we need more manufacturing capability? Does that mean we need more equipment? Where is the equipment? How much of it do we have? Do we need to get more? How do I access it? What's the best ways to distribute it? Truth in lending, that's what the U.S. military does. We're told to figure something out. We define the problem. We take in as much information as we can, facts and valid assumptions. We develop courses of action. We understand the risk of each of them and we make a decision and we move out. If the decision wasn't working out best, you assess what do you need to do to keep it moving? What do you need to change? Or do you got to go to a different one, right? And that's just the way we operate. And that occurred on a couple occasions. And we just got through it. I'll give you a simple one. I think we were 2 weeks into delivering the vaccine. First week of 5 million doses went out. The second week, almost 15 million doses went out. The third week, we were about to put 20 million doses out. And a major snowstorm hit the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Shut down all of our distribution centers. Shut them down. 6 and 7 feet of snow, right? And so what do we have to do? We had to, see ourselves, understand who didn't get what, where it had to go. And I told the team, I said, okay, I got it. Tell me when the snow's going to be gone. Go figure it out. And then tell me how you're going to not only deliver this week's, but next week's vaccine at the same speed, right? So I essentially doubled their requirement. And I said, and you don't get any extra time. Conversation's over. Well, that takes data and information and planning and execution and teamwork and people don't know,
Yeah.
The people in California were mildly interested in the snowstorm. Where's my vaccine?
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Thinking about their arm and their life.
Right?
Yeah.
But I would call the governor, say, "Hey governor, here's what's happening." We had a great interaction with all the governors.
Yeah. And I heard you saying you were good at voice recognition by the end. Someone would get you on the phone and you know which governor it was, which mayor it was. You probably haven't met. There are probably times when you have never even met these people in person. And maybe since you retired, you did.
Oh, absolutely.
And you're like, oh, yeah. Remember the 30 calls we had over the Zoom and the phone? Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, the phone calls, depending on what, and rightly so, they were the leaders of their states. And, you know, I appreciated they were taking responsibility and being accountable, some way better than others. But, you know, at the end of the day, they were all rowing, trying to do what was right.
This was an unbelievable accomplishment, an unbelievable American accomplishment. And then in the wake of it, I don't know that it is, I think the best that we could say is that it's by and large been taken for granted. And maybe the worst we could say is we're still squabbling about petty things related to or just totally papering over this unbelievable accomplishment.
Look, I got to tell you, my grandparents came here early 30s, right? Small business owners, really worked hard. You know, I was given opportunities to go to college and rise to the highest levels of the Army. I just am a big believer this is the greatest country in the world. And to that end, when we work together collectively as a nation, we can get anything done. And nobody can do anything to us. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty proud of the way that happened. You know, we had a defined purpose. We had priorities and resources. And we had unity of effort, right? Despite, you know, red or blue or all this crazy stuff going on, the people that were responsible for doing it were working together every single day to get it done. And it's okay to have, you know, disagreements, not disrespect. You know, you want that when you're trying to do things, yeah. But at the end of the day, decisions were made and we drove on it and we held ourselves accountable. It was the hardest I personally ever worked. You know, it was 7 days a week. They were really long days. And I've been, you know, I've been to Iraq 3 times, twice as a commander and once as a staff officer, and so it was worth I was supposed to retire when I got the call. I was a month out from retirement, right? And my wife heard me talking to the chairman. I walked out. I told the chairman, okay, we're moving. I'll be up there on Monday. I walked out the door. My wife, who just remarkable person, she says, okay, I guess we're not retiring. Give me the timeline. I'll figure out how to move what we need to move you, right? I mean, that's how it went. Ready, go.
Yeah.
Because that's what we needed to do. And I personally think it made a huge difference. There's some, you know, every once in a while, somebody recognizes me. I got on a plane a few months ago. And I usually sit down, I put on the headphones and I just, you know, I start reading. A nice lady tapped me on the shoulder. So I took off my headphones and she goes, I know who you are. And I said, okay, great, mm-hmm. Thanks. And I put my headphones back on. And then she tapped me on the shoulder. And I took off my headphones. And she goes, I didn't take the vaccine. I said, hey, that's a personal choice. Uh-huh. You know, what I'm proud of is we made it available for you to have that choice. And I put my headphones back on. And she taps me on the shoulder again. And she goes, don't you want to know why? I said, no.
She doesn't seem great at taking cues, by the way, but go ahead.
I said, no, it was a personal choice. I'm not upset. That's what makes us a great country, right? I did what I was told to do. We worked hard at it, you know, and it's your, well, I don't know what was in it. Okay. Well, this time I couldn't avoid. I said, hey, do you take the flu shot? She goes, oh yeah, every year. Oh, what's in the flu shot? I don't know.
Yeah.
What? What? Okay. And I put my headphones back on and I went, you know.
I want to ask you a couple of questions just about your expertise and maybe one or two about your biography. One, how attenuated should the supply chain be? I understand that there are risks, and when it breaks down, we all say, oh my God, we can't get these necessary items into America. But at the same time, it's not 1954, and it can't be that everything is made from the factory within 100 miles. So is there a good answer to that?
This is my personal opinion, okay? Just so everybody listening, I don't... The supply chain is defined by the purpose you give it. If you're an industry company president, CEO, and you define the supply chain as something that's necessary, but you want it to be cheap, right? Because you want costs to go down, well, that's what's going to happen. It's going to get disrupted. Things are going to happen. Ports are going to close. Transportation nodes are going to be cluttered or shut down, or something's not going to be available. If your purpose is, I always want my supply chain to enforce and enable quality manufacturing on time, then you make different decisions. You have multiple places to get it. You set up multiple supply chains, you put in different storage capability, et cetera. Now, that's an extreme, those two examples I gave you. My point is, it's the leadership decision. And we're a global world, and I don't think that's ever going to change. And I think it's...
Well, also what that tells me is that there's no right answer. There's only trade-offs.
That's right.
And just be very intelligent and purposeful about understanding those trade-offs.
If I was a board member and some CEO was telling me, oh, we can't get all this done, our profits are down because the supply chain is not working, I'd say, oh, bull crap. It's not because of the supply chain. It's because we didn't lead our way the right way. We didn't make the right decisions. That's what I fundamentally believe, right? You know, barring nuclear war, right? Or a satellite or a meteor hitting the Pacific Ocean and wiping out everything. That's what I personally believe. Now, as you alluded to, do I think we could do a lot more in this nation, manufacturing, both, you know, supply chain and end products? Yes, I do. With that said, it is really expensive to make things in America, right? For all the right reasons. We have the best safety. We have the best environmental laws. We believe in taking care of people, right? You know, treating them right. But that is really, really expensive to do. And you got to understand that. You don't make the cheapest car while you're paying all those things. So it's a trade-off in the decision-making of that, right? I was in an audience and somebody says, General, I know you believe this, we got to make everything in America. Well, not so fast, you know, Ranger. We got to make the right decision.
Last question. I watch many news conferences where you took responsibility and you say, that's on me, and you don't have your doses. And I don't know, maybe you were taking one for the team, but it seemed you were very forthright. Now, in reading about you and talking to you, you also had a lot of power. So maybe you were able to absorb some criticism. It did strike me as very contrary to what most leaders, definitely most elected leaders, do. They usually deflect criticism. So knowing that you maybe were in a different position than someone who relied on the will of the electorate, do you think in general leaders can take a lot more blame than they think they could take?
Yes. I think no matter what position you're in the position of responsibility and accountability. Right? I don't care if you're a CEO of a company or if you're an elected official or you're an army general. I don't care. End of conversation. This crap that we give people, we accept that, you know, that they're not responsible and accountable is going to be a problem. Now that's how I grew up. I had great leaders. I had great parents. I had great leaders. And you were allowed to do those things. Now, didn't mean you weren't going to get fired. You know, we don't suffer fools or incompetence. And you're not allowed to make the mistake over and over again. You know, this is not likeship, it's leadership. But I'm a fundamentally believe two things. One, Leaders have to think bigger than themselves and bigger than their organization, right? It's not about them. It wasn't about me, right? It was about my purpose, safe and effective vaccines for the American people, right? And it wasn't, about, what happens if we don't, if we got this wrong, you know, the side is going to get mad. And that's, I was mildly interested in it. That's why I was able to do what I did. Now, I'm not going to get into the details of what that situation was, but trust me, I took care of it, and I was not going to be distracted by the media doing a bunch of stuff or a bunch of people pointing fingers. And so, look, to my second thing, I'm responsible, I'm accountable, right? And we'll go from there. You think it's so bad, then fire me. Okay, but I'm going to look myself in the mirror and I'm going to move out. And I think if more people did that, if elected officials say, well, now what's the purpose of me being here? To do what's best for my state and my country or for me to get reelected? You know, I mean, come on. That's crap.
Gus Perner is a retired U.S. Army 4-star general. He served as Chief Operating Officer of Operation Warp Speed. Thank you so much.
Mike, thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.